L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Well, everybody, hello, hello, hello. Yes, it is the holiday season and impeachment season, apparently, as well. We'll get into that later. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's such a pleasure having you all along for the ride. Well, folks, I'm excited about this holiday for a lot of reasons, but particularly the holiday for this podcast, because I've got my first ever presidential candidate on the podcast today. Very excited about welcoming Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. She is an author and motivational speaker who was an anti-war activist and worked with people with HIV and AIDS. She has embraced liberal policies on climate change, universal health care, and criminal justice reform, and that's small L liberal. Describing the country now as having a, quote, sociopathic economic system, which I want to dive into with her about that. Ms. Williamson has embraced reparations to heal wounds caused by slavery and has actually been sort of a standout candidate. Even though she's not on the stage, she's still in the race. And I think that's an important note to make. Ms. Williamson, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm honored to be here.
It's an honor having you, and we're excited about the conversation we're going to have today. So let's just start with where we are, the state of your campaign at this point, the sort of the rules that the DNC have put in place, and I'm all the more familiar with those rules as a former national chairman. You draw lines. I'm not a fan of that necessarily because I think you lose the opportunity to have some important voices at the table, and yours being one of them, because at the moment you were catching fire with a lot of voters out there, the rules changed the way you could play in the game. So where are you now in your campaign? What's the latest for you and going forward?
Well, you, as you said, know very well what the game is here, and it shouldn't be a game. The Constitution does not even mention political parties. And George Washington warned us against them in his farewell address. He said that people would become more concerned with their factions. He said it would cause factions of men. Mm-hmm. We would become more concerned with their factions than with their country. And I think that it has gotten to that point. I think the role of a political party, the role of the DNC, the role of the RNC should be to facilitate democracy, not in any way to dictate democracy. And I think right now what is happening is that democracy itself in many ways is being suppressed. You know, the role of the primaries, the whole point of the primaries is to, quote unquote, narrow the field.
Right.
And I don't see any reason to, quote unquote, narrow the field until the voters until the voters weigh in.
So you're in this thing. You're going to stay in it and hang in it as long as you can, right up to the beginning of the first ballots being cast in Iowa, I suspect, right?
Well, the issue is what it's as though there are two different political universes. And I know with your experience, you know this very, very well. One political universe is what the pundits have to say and the polls and the money and the huge machinery of what I call the campaign industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other universe that is very, very profound. And it goes all the way back to the beginning of our country. And it is that rather... there's an intimacy to it, an intimacy, obviously not personally, but philosophically and psychologically between the candidate and the voter. And that's where democracy happens. That's where the magic is. That's where the voters are listening to the candidates, and nothing should filter that. And I feel very strongly, having been in this process, that the voters in the early primary states particularly are very capable, thank you very much, of doing their own thinking. I think we need to remember that the airwaves belong to the American people. And I think that every candidate should have a particular amount of time on television.
Right.
And that should be it. Look what's happening today. I mean, I heard earlier today that Michael Bloomberg is going to skip the first four, that he's just going to go right over to Super Tuesday.
Right.
I mean, we're moving to a point, we're headed down the road where you're going to have to be a billionaire to run for president. So the whole thing has become so co-opted by forces of money and power that really do mitigate against the vital functioning of our democracy.
Well, you know, you raise a number of interesting points in that space, and some of which I agree with because I've seen the opportunities lost, put it that way, that a lot of candidates have because of the way the system is rigged. We all know, and let's just be very clear, and, you know, I try to be straight up with the folks who listen to this podcast. We all know that the political parties are not interested in, A, in having a lot of people run, B, they're not interested in having a lot of voters vote. They only want their voters to vote. And unless you're one of their voters, they don't want you voting. So you've got that as the foundation for a lot of this. So the idea of opening up the system to allow for a more energetic, direct engagement with candidates. I, for one, have been an advocate for a while for a national primary. I just hate the way this primary system is set up, that we start electing our president in Iowa, and if you don't win Iowa, then my God, you can't be president. Well, who, that's BS. Who said that? Where is that in the Constitution, to your point? So how do you then begin to correct this system so that a candidate like you, who got the chance to stay on the, to stand on the stage, to stay on the stage, to meet the early, meeting the early requirements of the Democratic Party, but then reached a point where the party went, okay, I'm sorry, you've been here longer than we need you. It's time for you to go. How do you begin to change that system? On the right, on the Republican Party side, you have states who've actually eliminated their primaries because they didn't want Donald Trump to be challenged in the Republican primary. That's so ass backwards, I can't even begin to express the outrage over that. So you can really see how these two systems, these two parties, set this thing up. So how do you break that logjam as a candidate like yourself, who, you know, once put to the side, has, you know, kind of loses the voice in a certain sense to call attention to some of this?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize what a crisis in our democracy this is. Mm-hmm. If you, who is a former chairman of the RNC, and Donna Brazil, who is a former chairman of the DNC, if the two of you crying foul doesn't change things, then,
right,
then imagine, you know, the powerlessness of someone like myself. I think what it's going to take is the American people waking up. And I think that, to be honest, that that's actually starting to happen. Democrats realized what happened last time, mm-hmm, in our party. The DNC put its finger on the scale, obviously. And if they hadn't, I don't think that Donald Trump would be president today. And from the perspective of someone like myself, it feels like they're doing the same thing today. We supposedly don't have a country anymore where, you know, party bosses with cigars in back rooms decide who the candidates will be. But are we sure about that? Because that's what really this amounts to.
Right.
One of the psychological things that's interesting to me is that it has not seemed to me like Republicans, and you would know better than I, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong. It doesn't seem to me that Republicans defer to the RNC as much as the Democrats defer to the DNC.
Okay.
Sometimes it's like they forget. This is just a private corporation. This is not a governmental functioning. And, you know, from the perspective of someone like myself, and in all the ways that you've mentioned, all that the debates are is a reality TV show. But it has a tremendous, tremendous influence on people, not only because of all the eyeballs who see the candidates, but because of this illusion that's created that there's something official going on here, when in fact there's nothing official going on there at all.
Well, to your point, there is an interesting point to be made about how the candidates and the party itself, activists, donors, etc., respond to the institution, the building, if you will. You know, you're right. Up until Trump, there, you know, the RNC had to always, you know, walk a little bit more carefully. You know, people would come because they needed cash, but by and large, there was a much larger or stronger independent streak from the institution itself. I remember when I was a state chairman, the party, you know, in an election cycle wanted to involve itself in Maryland elections. And I told them to stay the hell out. I'm like, no, I don't need you coming in here messing stuff up. You don't know the candidates. B, you don't know the people. See, this ain't South Carolina, so you can't come in here talking all this, you know, far right crazy, because I'm in a state where I'm out number 2-1 Democratic, right? So you had that dynamic. Trump comes and changes that now, where the party is really just lockstep to its own future detriment, I believe. The Democrats have always kind of fallen into that space where, and I think that was kind of the problems that Donna Brazile sort of ran into, where yeah, they were much more willing to tip the scales, put their fingers a little bit more on the scales than Republicans were, even though they had proportional representation, you know, proportionality in their delegate selection, for example. Yeah, that's great as long as it's not weighted. So you raise interesting challenges for future candidates who look at your race and others. I mean, there's still a lot of good candidates out there who weren't on that stage the other night, on that Democratic stage, which had been narrowed from 15 or 20 down to 6. And some would argue, but for the weighted finger on the scale, if you just let the campaign run itself and the candidates are able to stay in it up until, and I don't know who says you necessarily have to have all these debates anyway, run your race on the ground in the states, in the early states, try to create some traction for yourself and see what happens, right?
Well, it's not even that some would argue. It's indisputably the fact. There's nothing even an opinion there. It's not necessary. Nothing that they're doing is necessary.
So,
and it mitigates against democracy. It's undemocratic.
So let's shift away from the process of running for president and some of the what struck me about you, and I think it may have been either the second debate, I think it was the second debate, where you started to say some things that people at first were kind of, you know, to be honest, they kind of laughed at, you know. And when you started, you talked about policy almost from a spiritual standpoint, where you connected in a way the human nature of it. This is not just about black letter law or words on paper or, you know, pushing through some policy machine, an idea that spits out on the other end regulations that will then control, you know, how much money your state gets or how much health care you can afford. But you try to frame that policy from a humanistic perspective. In short, hey, there are people on the other end of this. How? And that struck me as a former seminarian, and as a former lieutenant governor who brought that sort of approach to a number of the policies that I advocated for when I was in office, that struck a nerve with me. And I think it struck a nerve with a lot of people out there. What's your assessment of that hunger right now in America for that level of raising spirituality? And I don't mean this in the, you know, traditional church, you know, religious sense. I'm talking about just recognizing the humanity of individuals and how policy has an impact on that.
I think people might want to read the Declaration of Independence again.
Good point. Good point.
Declaration of Independence is not just some dry,
right,
technocratic, rationalistic document. It's not just a political document. It is a document that lays claim to an earth-shatteringly different relationship between human beings and their government and the possibilities for their lives. It's a philosophical document as much as it is a political document. And all of the juiciness of that has been lost in our current age and to our detriment. But it is an aberration. That's what's important that we remember. It is an aberration that we have made politics so dry, that we've made it so rationalistic, that we have removed it as much as we have the deeper waters of human emotion and psychology. That's the aberration.
It's I agree with you. It's easier to manage it that way. I can, you know, from a party standpoint,
and to control it.
Exactly. Yeah, from a process, purely straight up, how much money comes in, how much money goes out, who's up, who's down, I can control that. Because if I exercise away from the game, that humanistic piece that you're talking about, that spirituality, that sort of underpinning and understanding of who we are relative to all other things, I dumb it down to that point. Hey, you know, I got way more control than I would otherwise and I think that was one of the things that the founders were so concerned about introducing this sort of, how do I want to phrase it? This sort of unfeeling sort of infrastructure, institutional, political body, you know, known as political parties. They wanted to keep it a little bit more fluid, recognizing the humanity of individuals, which you're right. Our founding documents are replete with that attitude.
Well, there are a couple of things about that. First of all, in the Jewish religion, it is said that every generation has to rediscover God for itself. And John Adams said that he hoped that every July 4th, Americans would revisit our first principles. And what has happened in our country is that we are too many generations away now from a time when people really psychologically and emotionally bonded adequately with the principles of the Declaration of Independence, which are not left or right, but they are deeply democratic, and they lay claim to a vision of God-given rights. Let's not forget that. God gave inalienable rights of life and of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Now, when you were saying a couple of minutes ago, and I agreed with you, it makes people easier to control when they are not bonded with those principles. Because when you're not bonded with those principles, which are essentially America's mission statement, you become easier to play. So when you have 13 million children who are hungry in this country, 100,000 children, and these are, for the most part, they're citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm. So 13 million of them are hungry. 100,000 of them are homeless. We have millions of American children who go to school every day in classrooms that don't even have the adequate school supplies with which to teach a child to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 8, then the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased. The chances of incarceration are drastically increased. Where is that child's right to pursue happiness? And it says in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted to secure those rights, and that if government is not doing its job, it's the right of the people to alter it or to abolish it. That's juicy stuff, Michael. That's the stuff of, man, if you're convicted around that, if the American people, just that alone, were bonded adequately and emotionally to those principles generation after generation, there is so much that now literally tyrannizes the American people that could never have gotten this bad because people would have cast it out years ago.
So that connect spirituality and healing somewhat in the same space. And where do you see spirituality playing a role in the presidency? Does it have a role there? We've had presidents who have been religious men, and a few who have even been spiritualists in their own right. But you're right, to at least in late 20th century, certainly in this century, that particular aspect of the presidency has been, and certainly under Trump, it doesn't even exist. I mean, you know, guys, you know, looking for 2 Corinthians, for God's sake, to help him figure out what's going on. But how does that play a role, in your view, in your presidency? As a President Williamson, how would spirituality and this idea of healing the nation around some of the principles that you've just mentioned come into play, particularly with respect to your policies, which we'll get into in a moment?
Spirituality is simply the path of the heart. That's all that it is. And I think that the average American is guided by heart. I think the average American does do their best to be guided by their sense of integrity, a sense of conscience, and a sense that we should do right by other people. But we have, over the last 40 years, allowed American capitalism and the U.S. government to so disconnect from any guiding principle of integrity and conscience that U.S. public policy, both domestic and international, is so lacking in alignment at this point with any sense of compassion, heart, or conscience. When you have, for the sake of $360 billion in an arms sale to that murderous dictator in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. that for the sake of that, we will give aerial support to a genocidal war. Genocide, Michael. Our grandparents would roll over in their graves. And when Mike Pompeo was asked, how could we do that? His response was that sometimes you can have strategic partnerships with people who do not share your values. No, you can't. That means you have no values. So we have sacrificed in both domestic policy and international policy any sense that doing right by people should take precedence over short-term profits at any given moment.
But President Williamson, how would you handle then those strategic relationships and alliances, some of whom are our allies who may not necessarily share the values as you see them as president or as the nation, or that you espouse on behalf of the nation as a whole? How do you then walk that tightrope where, yeah, I can understand dealing with an MBS, and I think we should revisit that relationship because I've never believed it was fair to us. In other words, that they were Saudi Arabia has really been a true partner in all instances. I get that. But then when you look at some of our other European allies whose values may be somewhat different from America's, which I still think at its core, Marianne, is very puritanical in some respects. How do you then translate that?
Well, sometimes it's black and white, like with the Saudi Arabians, and right. sometimes it's not. Let's say, like with the Chinese
right.
and what's happening with the Uyghurs. I mean, obviously, sometimes it's harder than at other times. It's more nuanced than at other times. Governance is not a science. It's an art. But no matter what, you can take a stand. And that is what has been the greatness of the United States. I don't think anyone ever thought that the United States always had it right. I mean, we have a history of slavery, for goodness sake. Nobody ever
right.
thought...
Exactly.
Yeah, nobody ever thought that the United States ever totally actualized the principles on which we purport to stand. But I'm old enough to be able to remember a time, and it was before the 1980s, thank you very much, mm-hmm. when at least it was the understanding of the consensus among the American people that we were supposed to try. I remember during the Vietnam War, the My Lai Massacre, and when American military personnel massacred a village of Vietnamese villagers.
Right.
Now, it happened. It's not like it didn't happen.
Right.
But what there was at that time on a national level with an appropriate sense of healthy shame. We all knew it was horrible. We talked about it. There were articles about it. We didn't just rush past it like it didn't matter. That's when you know a country is morally in trouble. It's not just what we're doing in Saudi Arabia. It's that everybody's not even talking about it. There was a bipartisan effort to stop the president there, but the president overrode that. They weren't able to override his veto. And the other day, in the spending bill that was affirmed by a Democratic House of Representatives, if anything, he got more power.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that we are doing now that don't even entail national conversation. Do you know that we have millions of American children who have been diagnosed with PTSD? That is no less severe than the PTSD of a returning veteran in Afghanistan, from Afghanistan or Iraq. We have elementary school students on suicide watch.
And a lot of those students are misdiagnosed as well. I mean, particularly
in
the black community, there's a lot of misdiagnoses, especially of young black boys, in a way that, you know, the longer-term impact and effects, not just on the community, but the country as a whole, is profound.
So why is it, even on the debate stage the other night, and I'm not in any way minimizing the horror of these children in cages. I'm not in any way minimizing the horror of the trauma of these children at the border. But let's be very clear here. The trauma of the little boys that you just described,
mm-hmm.
the trauma of the children that we're talking about here, poverty is a trauma. Hunger is
sure.
a trauma.
Absolutely.
These children, we're traumatizing and we're not even discussing it. This is when you know a nation is morally in trouble.
Well, and an interesting thing. Go ahead.
Well, you have one major political party who is too filled with forces, whose basic attitude is, yeah, what of it? But you have the other major political party, too many of which say, oh, it's so terrible. But neither one will challenge the underlying forces that are making all that suffering inevitable. And when you talk about spirituality, that is the goal of spirituality, and that should be the goal of politics as well, and that is the elimination of unnecessary human suffering.
Well, the power of what you're saying and the connection I think certainly real live people get and understand who live in these communities from Appalachia to Mississippi to elsewhere around the country is that the underlying impact on health, on jobs, on any number of other indices in their family and in their community is poverty. It's if you know the degree to which you are poor impacts so many other things in your life. It impacts the criminal justice system. It impacts the healthcare system, the educational system, etc. So if you can begin to address the economic condition of the individual. If a young man or woman sees a job opportunity in front of them, if an established, middle-aged man or woman sees an opportunity to transition from one line of work into another line of work, because just the nature of how work is, we know how that is. Or if an older individual sees an opportunity to stay in the market because they want to, not because they have to. All of these things sort of play into the mental health, the physical health, the emotional health of not just the individual, but the country as a whole, I think.
Well, of course, that's why today they use the term intersectionality.
Right.
Everything affects everybody.
Everything affects everybody.
And so today we're talking about a quote-unquote mental health crisis. Well, that's just the symptom. What we need to talk about is the cause. When you have 93 million Americans living in near poverty, that means 93 million Americans live every single day with the chronic economic anxiety of not knowing what will happen if they get sick, not knowing what will happen if one of their children gets sick, not knowing how they'll send their children to college, not knowing how they will get out from under these college loan debts. And so we wonder why everybody's so tense and anxious and desperate today, and this becomes little more than a gold mine for drug manufacturers. I feel like saying to these politicians, I'll tell you what you do about the mental health crisis, stop driving everybody crazy. And when you were just talking before about people who don't see a job opportunity, you know as well as I do, with these little kids who aren't even learning to read by the age of 8 years old, who by 10 years old are going to be so angry. This is going to turn into a job opportunity for people who put together mass incarceration and prison building as an urban industry. There will be no meaningful job opportunity for that child, and that child knows it. That's why I want a Department of Children and Youth. We have a massive problem, Michael, an invisible sea of suffering among millions of American children. I don't know where do you think these kids are going to be in 20 years?
And that question we're going to tackle with a President Williamson administration. We're going to take a quick break, and when we do, we'll come back with more with Marianne Williamson, presidential candidate, Democratic presidential candidate, right after this. Welcome back, everybody. We're having a wonderful, very enlightening conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. Ms. Williamson, I want to jump a little bit more into your policies because you've laid out some pretty interesting ideas. And in the first part of our conversation, I wanted to use more or less as an underpinning, an underline, so people can kind of get a feel of how you see things and how that may flow into a number of the policies that you have proposed. And we're going to start with one that I'm interested in. You call for a plan that supports a universal basic income, $15 minimum wage. I wish it were a $15 million wage. But right? That would change the tables a little bit in this country, that's for sure.
No, that would be Kuwait, right?
That would be Kuwait. Exactly. Fair point. But you call for the U.S. to adopt a nationwide $15 minimum wage and endorse a universal basic income of $1,000 a month. Now, your plan, as I understand it, is going to be funded by a 2% wealth tax on fortunes of greater than $50 million and a 3% tax on fortunes that are greater than $1 billion, as well as a, quote, tiny tax on Wall Street tax trading. Now, as you know, one woman's tiny is another man's, oh my God, this is massive. So walk us through your plan that supports all of this and how you pay for it.
First of all, that 2017 tax cut, $2 trillion tax cut, Michael,
right.
83 cents of every dollar goes to the very richest individuals and corporations. And there is no evidence that that thing will ever even pay for itself. So I believe we should repeal that tax cut, although we should put back in the middle class part of it, which I think should have been there to begin with. I think we should cut the corporate subsidies, such as $26 billion to oil and gas alone last year. I think it's ridiculous for the United States government not to be able to negotiate for lower drug prices with big pharmaceutical companies. And while I believe that the U.S. military should receive every dollar that they say they need in order to secure the safety of our homeland, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars over and above that, mm-hmm. which is not what the military says they need, but which defense contractors say
they want,
in order to increase their stuff. You, all of those things. Now, in addition to that, I think we have to really look deeply at where we think money comes from. We need to change for the sake of our societal health, but also for the long-term sake of our economy. We should shift from an economic to a humanitarian bottom line. What do I mean by that? Right now, we basically buy into the idea that money is produced in the form of job creation that's dropped like crumbs from the table of corporate chieftains up on some Mount Olympus somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's a corporate aristocracy. It's like the same kind of lords and ladies type stuff that we repudiated in 1776. That is not where wealth comes from. Even look at that. They don't even claim that's where wealth comes from. They claim it's where jobs come from. That shows you everything, the paternalism of that. There's really, for all that your party talks about wealth creation, there really even is wealth creation for a few, because jobs are not necessarily wealth creation. Where wealth comes from and where jobs come from is the creativity and the productivity of the American people. So to me, the idea of American democracy is so profound because it's the idea that anyone should get to soar. Anyone should get to spread their wings. Anyone should get to actualize their God-given potential. And you know what? when people do that, they tend to make more money. Let people get educated. Get rid of these college loans. You know, this $1.5 trillion college loan debt, I'm sure you know this as well as I do. All these kids want is they want in. They just want to be a bunch. They want to be young capitalists, and we're not letting them in. They don't have the $2,500 in discretionary spending that they would love to have to start their own project, their own website, and so forth. So what you've got, you know as well as I do, you tend to make more money, number one, if you're educated, and number two, if you're living your dreams. But we have millions and millions and millions of Americans who are in jobs they hate, because they need to be there in order to have their benefits. So that means they're less good as employers and they're less good as employees. But you've got all these young people who they get the education because they feel they need the education to live their dreams. But then they end up with so much college loan debt that they don't feel they can go after their dreams, because if I go after my dreams, then it's not as probable I'll get to be able to pay off these college debts. So at the age of 25 years old, 23, 25, you're loaded with tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of college loan debt. They're not going to go after their dreams. They're going to create less wealth. They're going to create less wealth for themselves. It's going to be less wealth for our society. So the things we do to withhold, and that's what we do. We have governmental policy that thwarts people's dreams rather than supports people's dreams. And if we support people's dreams, we'll all make more money.
I'm gonna applaud that last line, because one of the things that's always kind of stuck in my craw, for example, to your very point, I think education costs should be absolutely able to be written off by middle class families, period. I mean, if you're not going to be honest and go to university and say, cut that crap out, because I served on a number of university boards, major institutions, and I've always asked in my service on those boards, why the hell are we raising tuition 15% this year when inflation is 3%? Why are we passing on this burden? And of course, the response when I was lieutenant governor in our institutions in Maryland, one of the responses I got, well, we have a lot of vice presidents. I said, well, let's have a few less vice presidents so we can lower the cost of tuition. So you have this dynamic. But one of the things that always drives me nuts, Mariana, is that so you create this incentive for me to, quote, save my money, right? So you say, oh, yeah, you can have a 401k. All right, great. So I can set aside some money. First, you cap how much money I can save, number one. Wait a minute. But this is a good year for me, so I can put away more than $6,000 or $7,000 if I'm married. I can put away $20,000 because I had a very good year. I made more money. I was able to save more money. Circumstances in my family changed, and I could bank more each pay period as opposed to having to spend it out because I'd already paid down credit cards or whatever. But no, the government tells me I can only save so much. Then something happens where I've been able to save over the last 3 or 5 years. I've got $75,000, $100,000 in the bank. Family crisis comes along. I want to dip into that early because I need to deal with this. And the government says, oh, no, you can't have that money. And if you do, not only are we going to tax you, but we're going to penalize you. So
that's right.
We disincentivize people to actually. All this crap about wanting to save money. Oh, people should save. Okay. But then when I try to do that, you penalize me for doing it.
But that is over and over and over. We are no longer functioning. When Abraham Lincoln stood on that battlefield and said that all those men who died had given what he called the last full measure of devotion, so that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. And there he's referring, of course, to those principles in the Declaration. It's perishing now, Michael, because what you just described, that's not a governmental policy of, by, and for the people. So we have a government of, by, and for short-term profit maximization for health insurance companies and banks and pharmaceutical companies and chemical companies and food companies and gun manufacturers and oil and gas and defense contractors. This is what people in earlier times in our country would call tyranny, and they would not have stood for.
So how does your 2% wealth tax, your 3% tax on fortunes of $1 billion or more, and that tiny tax on Wall Street trading, which what would that number be? How does that avoid the middle class paying for this humanitarian bottom line that you're trying to create versus the economic bottom line?
Well, first of all, once you repeal your 2017 tax cut, you go back to the kind of corporate tax rate that there was before we even passed this. And we're not even talking about going back to what there was before the 1980s.
You're still talking about 37%, 37 to 42%, depending on, the range of dollars, right?
Well, hello. Well, corporations should pay into the national treasury. This is exactly my point. Why are we treating them like an aristocratic class? And look what has happened here. This is why you have the great wealth inequality we have. We've treated stockholders like old lords and ladies. What's going on here? This is why we have 1% of Americans who own more wealth than the bottom 90%. This is what has devastated our middle class, and this is what has created all of the economic tension and anxiety that you and I been talking about for the last few minutes.
Right. So let's shift gears. So you've got the economic piece that you want to sort of lay down as sort of the economic road to put the country on, with the nationwide minimum wage of $15, which is funny. I probably back in the 1990s advocated then for a $10 minimum wage because I grew up in a minimum wage household and knew that whatever that number it was at that time, it wasn't enough for us to meet our basic needs. So I understand that, and I appreciate that. And quite honestly, you know this, Ms. Williamson, that businesses, the way they plan and prognosticate, they build into those wages. They build into their short term and for short term 3 to 5 year window. What their costs are going to be. So this idea that if the minimum wage moved from $7 to $15 over a period of time, oh my God, people lose their jobs and the world would collapse is just utter crazy BS. It doesn't happen that way because businesses are smarter than that. They don't like it. Yeah, there are impacts along the edges, but this wholesale abdication of hiring people and we got to fire who we have is just crazy. So you've got this track. It is. So you've got this track that you want to build on. Then you layer on top of that your whole health plan. Now, your whole health plan, as I understand it, the idea is to expand health care, certainly the debate around health care. But how I haven't been able to really get my hands on what the plan would do. Is it a Medicare for all kind of plan? What exactly is your home health plan?
Okay. Now, this is really significant. Very core to my entire campaign is that we need to look deeper than just symptoms. The political establishment only wants to look at symptoms. It doesn't want to look at root causes. And one of the reasons it doesn't want to look at root causes is because of so often the fact that the political establishment is, in essence, the root cause.
Right.
Okay. Health is a perfect example. So we're talking about how we're going to pay for health care. Okay, great. But what we need to look at, we need to go deeper here. Why are so many Americans chronically ill at a rate so much higher than that of other countries of comparable wealth? That's what we need to look at. So as long as that's
processed
true, we have so much more health care costs. Processed food, carcinogens in our food, contaminants in our water, the pesticides, the herbicides, the chemicals, the toxins in our air, and even, to be honest, these economic policies you and I are talking about, because stress is one of the main indicators of the probability of disease. So the first thing is, I always say, I don't want to just be a president that provides universal health care. I want to be a president that provides greater opportunities for health. So you have to look at that. And if you look at that, you have to look at the corruption because you have to look at all the donations, the fact of the undue economic influence of the food companies, the chemical companies, and so forth. Do you know, Michael, McDonald's cannot make the same French fry in France that it makes in the United States because in France they're so much more productive, they're so much more protective of their health care. So that's first of all in my health care plan that we're very clear. You cannot separate this from taking on these forces that cause so much more. You know, I was sitting on an airplane not too long ago with a gentleman who is a doctor at the National Institute of Health, And he was saying that the big thing over there is how much concern there is about drug-resistant bacteria, because there are so many antibiotics given to these animals in the animal factory farms, right? The thing goes into the runoff, goes into the water, and goes into the food. We have so much as drinking water. We're all saturated with antibiotics, and they have a lot of concern about this. So we have to look deep down at what's contributing so much to sickness. Secondly, we have in our medical schools, so many of our medical schools are overly influenced by donations from big pharmaceutical companies, that the curriculum is very pharmaceutically oriented. And in the average American medical school, the medical student takes one semester of a class in which the relationship between food and health is taught. Did you see a couple of weeks ago, it came out that heart stents, they have now established that with people who have heart stents, that actually a la people like Dean Ornish, his kind of work, mm-hmm. that the dietary change and lifestyle change is equally efficacious at the treatment of the same condition that people have the heart stent for. So in my health plan, when you go to the doctor, first of all, I want the government to compensate. I want much more robust education in America's medical schools, mm-hmm. regarding a larger, more integrative look at health and healing and wellness, right? There's more, I mean, let's not kid ourselves, there's more corporate profits right now to be made on sickness than on health.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's just what happens with a profit-making healthcare system. So once again, what are you going for here? Are you going for the health of the American people, or are you going for short-term profits first and foremost for health insurance companies and big pharmaceutical companies?
We don't incentivize people to really be healthy.
Exactly.
We actually penalize them.
Yeah. That's exactly my point, and that's what my healthcare plan addresses. Now, when you go to the doctor, and the doctor prescribes whatever your situation is. Mm-hmm. And your doctor might take a pharmaceutical approach, a surgical approach, because that's the education that doctor has received. A la my plan, it is mandated that the patient be shown, it's like a patient, you know, Bill of Rights type of thing, that the patient be shown statistically, scientifically established evidence where dietary and lifestyle changes have any kind of a comparable benefit. And the insurance has to pay for that as well.
So in other words, instead of getting the stent, the doctor, as the first resort, the doctor also puts in front of the patient. But if you did this, health regimen in terms of your diet, in terms of exercise, in terms of lifestyle changes over the same period of time at way less cost, you're going to improve your health.
Let's stay with that, Michael.
Right.
You got it. Way less cost to you and way less cost to the government.
So, okay, how do you get people... Hey, you're dealing with human beings here. You know, how do you get people to suddenly go, I got to get up and exercise in the morning.
Okay, I love this. Are you ready for this?
Yep.
A physician in Utah was telling me this. We need health coaches.
Health coaches.
We need government, health coaches. Health coaches who will actually, because what you're just saying is very true, and doctors will say that all the time. They'll say, I will tell someone that this dietary change would help them, this lifestyle change would help them, and the patient will often say, it's too complicated for me. I can't even figure out how to do that. Just give me the pill.
Yeah, right.
It would actually
just give me the pill. I'm good.
right. But it will actually save the government money that person have access to a kind of health and wellness mentor, health and wellness coach, who actually will make it easier for people. Another place where you see this is in regenerative agriculture. So we have done so much harm to the farmland in this country, in places like Iowa, for instance, mm-hmm. so much harm to the topsoil because of what agribusiness has done, increasing short-term profit as opposed to the kind of age-old respect and understanding of the land. This has caused such devastation. It's caused devastation to farmers, their huge bankruptcies, suicides, etc. However, if you say to a farmer at this point, to transition to regenerative agriculture so that we can repair what we have done to the earth and put our agricultural system back on track and into alignment with the natural systems and healthy food and healthy lives. It's not so much that farmers don't want to do it as that, number one, it's more complicated because right now it's three easy steps, right, that agribusiness has to take. But number one, it's not only more complicated, but it's going to take a little more time to increase the yield in a way that will make the money. So the government should actually, just like with the health coaches, we should have regenerative agriculture coaches that the government will send out to any farmer who wants it, who will show you how to do it, who will come out and visit every 2 weeks or every month and help you.
What if they don't want it? How do you?
Well, if they don't want it, then nobody should be.
I hear what you're saying, and I see where you're going with it. But you still have to deal with this aspect of human nature that's now even more elevated from a partisan standpoint, because I can see some red state folks going, oh, hell no, I ain't doing all that. I don't need no coach coming and telling me how to eat and all of this stuff.
Hold on, Michael. Nor should anybody be forced to.
Right.
Don't get me wrong.
Now, no, I understand.
This is where Eisenhower said. So, no, I'm just saying availability.
Here's my question. How does that impact your overall health plan if you have a system, and this has been the debate among Democrats who, you know, talk about a universal health care system, Medicare for all. So you look at Warren and Sanders, who will mandate that I give up my current health care for their government health care plan, versus a Joe Biden who says, well, you got an option, and Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar are also in this space, where you have an option. And it sounds like what you're saying is we're not going to mandate it, but we're going to incentivize it in such a way that what we're offering is a better plan than staying where you are. Is that where you're headed in your plan or
well,
what?
Yes. And it is in the option space. Definitely. Because I found the Medicare for All, one of the things I don't like about the Bernie Sanders type of Medicare for All, it's very inflexible. You get the treatment that they give you, and that's it.
Right.
You know, like something out of the 1960s for me. So the inflexibility of that, given all of the exciting ideas about health and wellness and the treatment of disease that are out there today, I want people to have more choice, not just in terms of insurance. I want people to have more choice in terms of their treatment. So mine is a health is an option, including the option of the same health care plan that senators and congressmen get.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. So as we wind up, you have been enormously generous with your time, and I really appreciate it. I did want to get your thoughts on impeachment and where we are. The House impeached the president. We are now waiting to see exactly what the Senate trial will look like and the drama and you know, sort of anticipation of that. How do you assess this impeachment process, the impact it could have on the Democratic primary process, the eventual nominee, and how voters are from what you're hearing out there on the street as you campaign now? What are they saying about it, and how do you think it plays come November?
Well, I'm old enough to remember Watergate.
Right.
And I remember the electricity that was in the air. I remember not only the statesmen that you saw on both sides of the aisle and how seriously they all took their constitutional role, but even more importantly, there was a sense that it deeply mattered. Today, in ways that many Democrats don't want to face, it's a big ho-hum for a lot of people. And I think one of the reasons it's a big ho-hum for a lot of people is because people instinctively know Donald Trump did not create all these problems. These problems created Donald Trump. Donald Trump, to me, is a symptom and not a cause of the deepest dysfunctions in American democracy today. And I think a lot of people look at the Democratic Party and say, well, you know, it wasn't all that perfect when you were here either, you know. Because I believe I believe that Trump won because he and Bernie Sanders named people's pain.
Two sides of the same coin.
There was such rage.
I agree.
Such rage, and Hillary didn't name it. I'm not saying she didn't care. She didn't name it. And people want to feel that their pain is seen and that their despair is borne witness to. So it did not surprise me at all that there was going to be a populist rage that was expressed. It was either going to come through an authoritarian populist like Trump or a progressive populist like Bernie, which is why I believe 2 years ago Bernie would have beaten him. Now, everything that people experienced at that time, when Hillary came around saying, let's just continue the success of the last 8 years, millions of people felt like, what success? I'm freaking drowning here. So people are not stupid. This is the biggest disagreement between myself and what I see as so many people in the political establishment. They seem to think Americans are stupid. And we're not. The American people are very smart.
Right.
And they know when they're being played, even though they don't necessarily know how it went down. So I think when it comes to the impeachment, people know. And look, I supported the inquiry. If I were a member of the House, I would have voted yes. But I would not have voted yes under any illusion, this is going to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many people lined up behind Donald Trump. If we do not address these deeper problems, then even if we impeach him, even if we defeat him at the polls in 2020, those people will be back in major force in the midterms in 2022 and in the presidential election for 2024. And that poses a real problem for everyone with soul in your party and everyone with soul in my party. And that's how I see it. That if we think it's as simple, he's a hydra, you see.
Right.
You cut off that head, another one's going to grow until we address the deeper moral and democratic rot that has set into our system.
Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. Wow, I've enjoyed this conversation. And I think the last points that you made sum up so much of my personal experience in politics and what I've seen happen and how it has changed and transformed not just politics, but more importantly, how we engage with each other. And you absolutely nailed it when you said that Trump and Sanders named people's rage because it said it to those folks at that moment, finally, someone gets what I've been trying to say and what I feel. Appreciate your coming on the on the podcast, taking time off the campaign trail. I wish you the best of luck out there.
Thank you.
And enjoy it and have as much fun as you can, right?
Thank you very, very much. Tell people to go to my website, okay? Marianne2020.com.
Marianne2020.com. Check it out. Learn a little bit more about this Democratic presidential candidate, as you do with all of them. She's got a message out there. She's got something to say, and it's absolutely worth listening to and learning about. Thank you so much, Marianne, for coming on.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, that does it for this episode. So glad you could be a part of it. Thank you for the downloads. We love you for doing that. Stay tuned. Of course, you know you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. Check you out next time. You guys have a great one. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.